the COVID-19 pandemic made you think differently about welfare and charity. Perhaps you're needing government assistance for the first time yourself, or you might be mobilising to help your neighbours or assist in other ways. We'd love to hear from you. Tim Costello is with us. He's the co-chair of the Charities Crisis Cabinet, which was set up in response to COVID-19. Tim, welcome to Life Matters.
Lovely to be with you, Hilary.
Now, this is a big challenge for the charity sector. How's it been affected?
Well, the charity sector has suffered the downturn. People understandably who gave when they were busy, they said, I want to know that I can give money because I can't help and charities are there and that gives me comfort. Well, now people aren't giving. I mean, the good side is a lot of people who may not be giving are actually organising in their local streets and dropping casseroles. So charity has continued often beyond the professional charities. But the downturn means that those frontline services, running community houses, having events for people who are lonely, none of that can be done. And that is very dramatic. So charities were starting to lay off people. Thankfully, they're included in JobKeeper. But it has been a crisis for the charity sector that does employ 1.2 million Australians. Your listeners might be surprised just how extensive the charity sector is in this nation doing the heavy lifting.
And Tim, I understand too that apart from the monetary donations, there was also a diversion of some of the usual donated goods.
Yes, there was. So what we saw with some of the Second Bite and OzHarvest, who relied on out-of-date food for a whole lot of the soup kitchens that are running. The hoarding and the hoarding buying meant that a lot of those foods couldn't be donated, and suddenly food that was needed for people who were either on the street or living with food insecurity wasn't available. And then there were other donations also being sidetracked. So the ripple effects of this for the vulnerable in our community have been pretty significant.
And then there's the fact that charities, as you say, exist to help the vulnerable, but how do they do that when they can't physically get close to them?
Yeah, so there's wonderful examples still going on. Empower, which is run by Planet Shakers Church, have set up five different regional, effectively supermarkets in warehouses, where particularly international students and casuals, literally these people have missed out on JobKeeper and JobSeeker, and they can't get a ticket if they're an international student to fly home. They don't have the money, so they've got nothing to eat. So Empower, for example, has supermarkets where they go and have the dignity of choosing from these warehouse supermarkets what they want. They aren't just given a food bag. They can actually point out what they need, which gives them dignity. There's been so many of these measures also created with physical distancing to actually meet the needs.
And dignity is one of those things that's so important in a crisis and often falls by the wayside early. Tim Costello, will there be some charities that don't make it through this crisis?
Yes, there will be. The truth is that even when a snapback comes, which we all hope for, most charities do not have balance sheets with reserves that will be strong enough to see all of them through. The brand of charities, and we applaud this, is to say we want overheads as low as possible. We want money in and money out to serve people, to be really efficient. So a charity's brand, its reputation, is its only reserve. Well, when you're in shutdown and donations have shut down for 6 months without a balance sheet with reserves, yes, there will be a number of charities that probably do not get through this. Now, JobKeeper will help them at least assess whether they can survive and whether donations kick back. But most charities, particularly in the fourth quarter of the financial year, that's leading up to June the 30th, have a whole lot of public events. That's their big fundraising season. None of that's able to happen because you can't have public events. You can't bring in those dollars, which you normally do in that fourth quarter of the financial year before June the 30th. So there will be a number that don't make it.
Yes, and the talk of a snapback always makes me think of a rubber band when it might be more of a clawback over a period of time. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this too, if you're listening. Has COVID-19 made you think differently about welfare and charity, whether you're reassessing your attitudes to government benefits for yourself or someone else, or perhaps you have banded together with people in socially distant and safe ways to help out people who might be in need? I'd love to hear your story. Tim, just quickly, tell us about the Charities Cabinet before we come to Emma King from the Victorian Council of Social Service to broaden this out a bit. What does the Charities Cabinet want from government?
Well, the Charities Cabinet really is a voice to government, like the Business Council of Australia or the trade unions. They have always had very clear leadership and clear profiles, so they get invited to the table. So the initial stimulus package, the charities weren't even in that. And that's because charities are so different. In Community Council for Australia that I chair, it includes the RSPCA, Music, Aviva. It includes Smith Family and Save the Children. So profoundly different areas of charities, but fragmented, without a voice, without being able to be invited to the table when you represent 1.2 million Australians employed in the charity sector, when you're 8% of GDP, but sort of invisible under the radar, just doing in your particular area charitable work. So the Charities Cabinet, firstly, is a focus and a voice to government saying, include us. Now, we were then included in the stimulus package, but initially we were sort of forgotten because you just expect charities to get on with doing what they do and not to be there at the power table. The second thing is we've been writing to government and they've been responding, saying, look, for many charities, there's 30% downturn in revenue before, you know, you can apply along JobKeepers. Is hard to assess, and there's been a ruling, well, it can be 15% drop in revenue for charities. Government have responded, and we commend them for that. So the Charities Cabinet really is there advocating for this safety net, which is so important in Australia, but often fragmented and not visible and not heard.
Indeed. And perhaps if you're listening, you might have changed the way you donate or you give your time or you consider the issue of charity in Australia. I'd like to hear what changes this pandemic has brought to your way of thinking. If you're listening in the eastern states, the number's 1300 225 576. We're with Tim Costello at the moment, but also, and he's co-chair of the Charities Crisis Cabinet, which was set up in response to COVID-19. But also with us is Emma King. She's the CEO of the Victorian Council of Social Service. Emma, welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning, Hilary.
Now, we heard Tim mention the JobKeeper and also there's the JobSeeker payments. What are your thoughts on this massive amount of spending that's been announced in the form of a temporary boost to payments for people seeking work and the $130 billion in wage subsidies for people who have been in work? Is that enough?
Just to flag, I can't actually hear Tim, so I'm hoping that I'm not repeating anything that he said. But look, what I want to flag is one of the big changes that we've seen. So first of all, is it enough? I think we're hearing loud and clearly from people is that we're seeing quite an unprecedented shift in terms of the welfare that's being extended more generally. What we do know, though, is that we're seeing this really huge shift in terms of previously, I think that as a country, there's been some kind of, it's kind of the deserving and the non-deserving in terms of blaming individuals perhaps who find themselves out of work, when the reality is so many people are just one pay slip away from, you know, being in difficulty anyway. So just months ago, there was a real narrative that if you were unemployed, you needed to try harder to find a job, or that people in poverty simply needed to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. So the onus was very much on the individual, not on society as a whole. And once you think, well, the individual's to blame, it's much easier for a government to be punitive, and you can make payments measly and you can expect people to live on $40 a day, when we know those sorts of things are not realistic. And the minute that was hitting the broader population, And we had those incredible images of people lining up at 4:30 in the morning outside of Centrelink. It just wasn't okay. So it's interesting to me that it's sort of taken a pandemic for some to realise that this was really mean-spirited status quo. And even with this amount of welfare that's been, you know, pushed into the system, and we're looking at things as well like, you know, rent assistance and free childcare, as well as, you know, the job seeker payment and the job keeper payment, you know, we know as a community that we're really in trouble, and we've really got to stick together as we continue to navigate through this.
There's also a change in that the if you're eligible for government support as long as your partner earns less than $79,600, and that's been raised from $48,000. So there's this recognition that middle Australia is feeling this too. What effect do you think that might have, Emma, in the long term?
Well, I would hope that it makes us a more empathetic and compassionate society. I think, you know, one of my observations in the time I've been in this role is there's this really, and probably before, is that it's almost the deserving and the undeserving. And now that it's hitting everyone, like we're watching the fact that we've got a health crisis, an economic crisis, and now that it hits everyone, I think, you know, as a society, we get to decide whether we stay that way when the virus is defeated as well. So I do think for many Australians, poverty and hardship was something that happened to somebody else. Now it's touching everybody. And so if you or someone you know hasn't lost their job or taken a massive pay cut or is not really sick, then you're very, very lucky. So hardship isn't academic anymore. It's very much in our face.
Though there's an interesting kind of back and forth in the last couple of days. We saw this suggestion that casuals who had a very patchy work relationship might be included in some of the payments. But then this morning, Attorney General and Minister for Industrial Relations Christian Porter shut down that idea on RN Breakfast. What are your thoughts on that?
Oh, look, I think we know, particularly when we look at, you know, the businesses that were hit hardest in the beginning. So if you look at hospitality, tourism, you know, the gyms, et cetera, that were closed, they are businesses that are predicated. You know, their use of casuals is really, really high. We know that we've got millions of casuals in Australia that rely very, very heavily on that income coming in. And with it being taken away for them, it's devastating. And I don't think, and the point you're making is right, because it's not also only casuals, it's also looking at people who are here on temporary visas and migrant workers as well, who are being excluded. So that's actually a really great point, because we're seeing again this the sort of middle Australia being picked up in a way that others have been left behind, and been left behind for 25 years, let's face it. And now suddenly if you're a casual, you're not included, or if you know you're a migrant worker, you're told but in effect, you are being told to go home. So I think that we need to keep calling that out, because that isn't good enough. So we're seeing, you know, quite significant, you know, stimulus happening within the economy. But again, you know, we are seeing some that, you know, you're deserving and someone else is considered not deserving. We actually have to look at how we get through this as a broader economy and a broader society. We can't be leaving people out. It just isn't going to be acceptable.
Let's hear what our listeners think. Love to hear your thoughts as we're chatting here with Tim Costello from the Charities Cabinet and Emma King, the CEO of VCOS. Jason is in Victoria. Jason, what changes have you started to make in your thinking?
I have been thinking that we need to include people, and there is a song by relating to your topic called Bleed the Same Shit there on YouTube. And we need to, as Australians, remember we will bleed the same as Mendesa says.
And has it changed your day-to-day behaviour, Jason? Have you been doing things differently?
I have encouraged a lot of people, like I normally do.
So you've been reaching out even though you can't go out and helping people that way?
That's right.
That's great to hear. Thanks for your call, Jason. And Linda in Sydney, welcome to you. What's happening in your head, I guess, and at your place?
Well, I've been thinking about this for a while, but maybe now's the time to change it. When you get the tax return form or your tax return information, it itemises where the tax is spent. And the first thing is the amount of money that's spent on welfare. And it's just worded in a way that's kind of feels ideological, and that it's a bad thing to be spending money on welfare. And I'm just wondering if now is the time to turn that wording around so that the message that we get is that we should all be paying tax to maintain this safety net, because it's apparent that we really need it at times like this.
That's a really interesting idea, isn't it, Linda? I'm wondering, though, if people's reaction to it comes from a pre-existing bias. Maybe there's work we need to do on a whole host of levels to change people's thinking around that.
I think so. But I also think that governments should not be guiding people to resent helping each other out, but government should be saying, yes, this is what we need to do to, we're a community and we need to look after each other.
That's a really interesting idea, that idea of community. Linda, thanks for raising that.
Okay, no worries.
And to Pamela in Brunswick. Pamela, who's on your mind at this time?
Well, my particular concern is those who are going to miss out in this generous package. It's great that the government is considering that we are all in this together, and we are, Australia, we are so lucky. Look at our death rate, 37. I'm looking at Belgium and Netherlands, where my family live, 1,500, thousands dying. The strength of our community is reflected in the way we're responding, but we mustn't fall down on the job. We're looking at a million people who are missing out, New Zealanders. Surely we can extend the generosity to our New Zealand cousins who are doing the same to us in turn. Then we look at the temporary workers, the migrant workers who've come into this country and filled jobs that nobody else had. And then my particular concern, the people on bridging visas. These are people who, through no fault of their own, are waiting up to 7 years for their cases to be finalised. And while they're on a bridging visa, when they lose their work, they have no access to Centrelink or to rent assistance. Already I'm getting calls from people who, where the breadwinner in the family has lost their job and they've got the rent due in 10 days.
It's getting to the pointy end, isn't it, Pamela? And I think that you have worked and lobbied in this area for a long time, Pamela. It's good to get your response to that. I want to go to Tim Costello on that, Pamela, as well. Tim, Pamela mentioned that idea of the losses that we're suffering and going to suffer. And I saw a very moving post from Jed Carney from the ACTU the other day saying, yes, our number is, in quote marks, only 30, but one of those was my much-loved father-in-law. So every number is a person. What impact do you think that widespread loss of different kinds is going to have on Australians?
Well, I think the first thing is we're going to need to learn new ways to grieve, to lament. I think the tide of grief is only going to continue to grow. We've moved to higher ground, but we know that there is still some of the worst to come. The losses, economic, there. I can't go to my coffee shop and read the paper. In my case, I can't visit my 91-year-old mum and think, have I seen her for the last time? We know, well, I know, having just turned 65, that my fate and my generation's fate is in the hands of others. Will they be indifferent or will they physically distance? So this fear, anxiety and grief of loss is real. And I think we're going to need to find ways, without being able to go to funerals, to wear a colour that the loved one who's gone used to wear, to light a have a light in our windows, maybe at 7 o'clock at night, and a lot of the houses to actually recognise the grief of others who've lost someone. We're going to have to find new rituals to actually express grief, because this tsunami of grief and loss and anxiety is real. And we're not a culture that has been good at having rituals to recognise we are there for others. Communal grieving at a funeral is hugging and touching and embracing, and we can't do that now. So we really do have to take this this fear, anxiety, loss seriously and finding ways to express it.
And Tim, great loss and trauma can make some people reassess their priorities and turn outwards and embrace more people. And it can make other people really turn inwards and harden their hearts and just say, look, I just want to take care of my closest and dearest. How do we ensure that on a national level, we choose the former? We open our hearts to ourselves as a community.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Fear and anxiety is causing some Australians to actually turn on nurses and abuse them because they're fearful they might pass on the virus to them. We've seen the worst of fear. Equally, we know that fear and loss can give perspective. A person who's survived cancer will often say, I worked out what's really important in life. I'm getting rid of the froth and bubble. One of my favorite poets, Adam Lindsay Gordon, said, life is mainly froth and bubble. Two things stand like stone. Kindness in another's trouble, courage in one's own. So I think kindness and courage should be the response from fear and loss. And when you think of this nationally, we did this in the 1890s in the Depression. That drove us to federation as a nation, and we included women being able to stand for parliament and being able to vote, the first nation in the world to do both of those. New Zealand just gave women the right to vote. We included a living wage, the working person's living wage, that included even the cost of a daily newspaper, interfering with Master Servant Act and shocking the world by interfering and having a living wage. Post-Second World War, we said if we can build for war and mobilise, we can mobilise for peace. We want full employment. We want good services because we have shared vulnerabilities. So there we used the fear and the crisis to actually build a different society. Now, personally and socially, I'm hoping COVID-19 will be that for us, to include literally all of us.
But Emma King, CEO of VCOS, the Victorian Council of Social Service, what happens after this is over? The government's saying, look, we're only going to make these payments to support people out of work for 6 months. Once that problem stops affecting so many households, as you mentioned before, and stops being so visible, will it become acceptable to drop that rate of the job seeker payment again?
Well, I think that's a really good point, because they've got Scott Morrison already talking about a sort of snapback to business as usual. And I think that some economic measures will have to end, but I don't want us snapping back to this kind of nonchalant inequality and sort of casual acceptance of poverty. And I do wonder, once we see issues hit a broader group, like in middle Australia, I think that we can see quite a significant shift. I'm not so sure that it will be acceptable anymore. You know, the minute that a broad range of our population was going to have to survive on what was Newstart and less than $40 a day, suddenly that was not acceptable. We had everyone coming out saying this is not on, and government shifted. And when I say this, I say it in because neither party in the lead up to the election was adopting a shift to the Newstart allowance at the time. So we've now seen government step up really quickly and say, well, actually, we're going to double it, when it hadn't shifted for 25 years. So I think there's a really interesting piece in that about broader understanding, and actually not saying that, you know, we shouldn't allow ourselves as a society to be disinterested about poverty and inequality, or let our politicians be mean-spirited in how they respond to it. I think it goes to some of what Tim spoke about in terms of how we build the society we want, and how we as a broader community and Australians who vote, how we actually demand the society we want. And just to touch a little further on some of what Tim spoke about, I think a lot about how children are reacting to this as well, and some others who perhaps haven't been impacted before. But I think about the parts of our community around, we are seeing the best and worst in people. So we've seen the worst in things like the hoarding of toilet paper and those sorts of things, which is just pretty just dreadful. And then we're also seeing things like people putting notes in letterboxes saying, is there anything that you need? How can I help you? Can I do your shopping for you? We're seeing WhatsApp groups being set up, being mindful here around the digital divide. We're seeing neighbours really banding together and doing that in a way that I think in some neighbourhoods it already happened, in others it didn't. We're watching those good karma groups take off. So we're seeing lots of really good things about our community and a society, some of which rely on government, but others which rely on us and ourselves, and us, you know, working towards a community that we want and kind of walking the walk on that.
And there's a lot of interest in our callers today, as well as on our Facebook page, about how that us responds. Frank's in Nelson Bay. And Frank, as Emma mentioned, you're thinking about the impact on future generations. What's your thoughts?
Yes. I was born on the 14th of April, 1929. I welcomed my first great-grandson in June last year. And my mother died in 1931, and I was taken into care by the nuns at St. Patrick's Orphanage, Armidale, together with my brother and sister after my father's had a complete health breakdown. What I would like, as Tim was mentioning earlier, out of the Depression, lots of things changed. And I'm really concerned that in the, as we are in this, going into this major recession, the rate of inequality in the world is even greater now than it was prior to the Depression in 1929. We have a program on the ABC tonight about Amazon. And the owner of Amazon, as far as I recall, is reputed to be worth $300 billion. Now, I was wondering whether Tim will think that the younger people today will settle back and just accept this continuation of the huge inequality in the world and in our society here, or whether they will do what workers did in after the Depression and running up to the war and subsequent to the war. Because if they don't, we are in America and in here, the rich are going to get richer and the poor are going to, services are going to get even more stressed.
And Frank, I'll go to Tim on that in a second. It's a really good point and it's wonderful to hear your lived experience of those changes too. Thanks for your call. I want to go to a couple more calls before we finish up because there are so many people wanting to take part in this discussion. Kay is on the Mornington Peninsula in Victoria. Kay, what are you finding in people's attitudes at the moment?
Well, thank you. What I find is that this is not a happy story. This is not a story about thankfulness, kindness, or anything like that. What I've experienced is exactly what the last caller said, that actually the rate of inequality is becoming greater and that the services that are out there are really now just operating with voicemail and so on. You can't really get any help. And what has happened to me is that I rent and my agent is pursuing an eviction notice. I have to be out by Good Friday, which is a tremendous shock. Because they had issued the notice to vacate, which I was, you know, happy to do, they noticed to vacate prior, this is in December, prior to the COVID-19 outbreak. However, I'm over 65. I'm actually in a high-risk category and I have doctor's letters and so on that say this cannot go ahead. But these agents are using the 20 things that you can be out for, which one of which includes moving, to vacate houses arbitrarily. I am not a person who hasn't paid my rent. In fact, if anyone wants a wonderful tenant who pays rent and does upkeep, I'm it. But what I've found trying to reach to social services is that it's like vaporware. You go round and round in circles and, you know, there really isn't any actual help.
And Kay, so, I really feel for you. You're in a category that sadly is growing and I hope that you can get some help eventually online through the Tenants Union in Victoria and if that doesn't work, going to VCAT. I know it's a very difficult situation for you and I wish you all the best. Let's go to Merle in Ballarat. Merle, what's happening for you? Are you changing your thinking about giving at the moment?
Well, a little bit, because I think people like me who have no debt, I'm a semi-retired person, other people, people like me too, who are self-funded retirees, our expenditure has dropped considerably. So I think we should be seeking out charities and favourite groups, like arts groups in my case, to make donations to try and tide them over. I mean, small things we can do too, like share produce from our garden, and that's happening around my neighbourhood quite a lot. But I do also, you know, it made me think, Stateless last night brought back the plight of refugees, some of whom are in our communities and because of our stupid system are absolutely unsupported in any way at all other than by their communities. So there are lots of ways that people like us who don't have, you know, we just have more income at our disposal now to actually share.
Yes, it's a time of great gratitude for a lot of us, isn't it, Merle? Thanks for your call. You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. Let's hear from Don on the Gold Coast. Don, what have you come up with to get around the restrictions that COVID-19 has brought in?
Well, my wife and I, prior to her deceasing me, we believed right through our marriage that it was mentally more helpful if you helped people than if you asked for help. And whinging and whining about it doesn't help anybody, but the good feeling you get, or we got, from being beneficial to charities and so forth, was a buzz. And we frequently had house parties in our street. All the neighbours came. But with the affluence that's occurred over the last 10 to 15 years, majority of the houses in this older area have been rebuilt and with higher fences, and they don't answer their doorbells. So our charity collections were failing. We decided that we would ignore it because it wasn't successful, and we would give the funds that we normally collected out of our own pocket to local charities. That means places that we, organisations that we knew were part of, like from Life Saving and so forth. With her death, I've used the money that was part of her expenses of running the household into an addition, and I've added extra numbers to the charities from the 7 that we collected for to 15 now. This is not a lot of money, but it's important to these organisations, and it gives them more encouragement to survive. I know that some of the richest bodies financially in Australia are large charities, and a couple of organisations that are have always been very respected have huge budgets. One such organisation has something like 500 childcare homes or nursing or childcare centres, which is boggling in itself. But that's irrelevant to our situation locally. So we are putting the money into local people's charity pockets, and
Don, it's a really interesting point you raise, because we talked recently on the program to someone from a group called The Good Cause, and they're a not-for-profit that assesses charities' independence and trustworthiness. And they've got some really interesting information on their website for people who are wary about charities and the percentage that they might spend on staffing and admin costs. They talk about how important those spendings are. So it's well worth having a read if you're wondering where best to put your charity dollars. Don, thanks for raising that. I want to quickly go to our guests again before we finish up. Emma, can Australia afford to be this generous with these billions of dollars of payments to people out of work? I mean, subsequent generations are going to be paying this off for years on a national level and on a personal level. Is it worth it?
Oh, it's definitely worth it. I think it's more that we can't afford not to be this generous, because what's the cost? And the cost, if we're not investing back in our community and back in our society, is just going to be so grave. So I always have that image of the people lining up outside of Centrelink at 4:30 in the morning, because to me it just epitomises the level of fear and anxiety that they have, as on top of the grief that Tim spoke about as well. And to think, well, we have to do everything we can in terms of, you know, the pandemic for however it will last. You know, there will come a point at the end where we need to then think about the points I've been talking about today. How do we come back as a society, et cetera? And how do we hold that as much as we possibly can? Knowing also that some of the areas that we've invested in, they needed investment and investment for a long time. And there's other things I think we can let go, things like negative gearing, things like capital gains taxes, all the benefits that were there that actually helped people that were already doing all right. So I think we're going to need to shine a light on some of those things and look at actually which bits do we keep, because actually they're very important in terms of helping people put a meal on the table and being able to turn their lights on. And they're the sorts of things that we needed anyway.
Will we see a national reassessment? Yes, I wish we could talk for longer, but unfortunately we're out of time. Emma King, CEO of VCOS, Tim Costello, co-chair of the Charities Crisis Cabinet. Thank you both so much for joining us on Life Matters today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Radio National.